We'll now call the last case of the day. It's the case of Hutchinson versus Hutchinson. Mr. Barnes?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Counsel?
Great.
May it please the court. My name is Edward D. Barnes. I'm the attorney for Ann Hutchinson, the appellate in this case. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
And while I'm talking, I may forget to put something in here that was in my brief. I'm not waiving it. So any point I make in my brief, I'm reasserting it.
That's fine. Thank you.
The parties were divorced by final decree in Nelson County Circuit Court on September 1, 2006.
May I interrupt you? Are we bound by the agreement that apparently was reached among counsel that the property settlement agreement, or those the terms that are at issue, are not ambiguous? Is that binding on us?
Your Honor, I think that the standard review in this case is de novo, but I think that that stipulation counts, and I think it is not ambiguous. So I think the stipulation counts, but you'll review it de novo with that stipulation.
Isn't that a question of law that we're not bound by? Whether an agreement is ambiguous, a contract is ambiguous.
I think you're right, Your Honor. Our position is that the stipulation makes a difference,
yeah.
But I understand your point about the law, and I do understand that. After the property agreement was made and the final decree was entered, which stated that transcript says, Mrs. Hutchinson will pay to Mr. Hutchinson $1.4 million without interest, and the evidence of that obligation will be in this agreement and a final decree of divorce, and that obligation will be the final decree of divorce without interest to be paid to him if, as, and when all the Merritt Hutchinson properties sell. That's in the transcript. And then in the final decree, which is the last version of their agreement that's typed, it likewise says he would pay for $1.4 million if, as, and when all the Merritt Hutchinson properties sell. Or it's if, as, and when all the properties that make up the Merritt Hutchinson property sell. The Merritt Hutchinson property was a resort comprised of 12 parcels. And
if we're going to interpret this contract, we would need to consider each of the words that are used and apply to them their ordinary meaning, I would think. The word as, that the $1.4 million will be paid as the real estate, as all the real estate sells, as in all, seem at odds to me. Help me there, please.
I don't think they're at odds. If all the property sells, when all the property sells, as all the property is selling. As tells you at the, contemporaneously when all of it's sold, it's going to be paid. So as is not in opposite to that. And you would have to ignore all to focus on as only. And so if the property sells, when all the property sells, as all the property sells is contemporaneous.
That's assuming that the property is sold. It seems to me that the way that was expressed, it contemplated that all the property would be sold at once. And so contemporaneous with the sale, as the sale is made, then this payment would be made. But of course, that's not how it's worked out.
That's how it worked out.
And if that's the case, what was the intent? Can we divine the intent from these words, or is it necessary to go back and take further evidence so that the intent behind the contract is what's carried through?
I don't think you need more evidence on this. In fact, neither of the lawyers did either. In fact, in this particular case, you're not going to divine anything different than the words that were used. And you can't just say, I'm going to ignore if, I'm going to ignore when, I'm going to ignore all because I want to focus on as.
Right.
When three of the words comply strictly with our interpretation.
But the word as, I think, doesn't have the same conclusive time limit on it, even if you take into consideration, which we do, the word all. I mean, as all the property sold, I think can be interpreted as saying, having with it that there is a continuation of sales as all the property is sold. It doesn't say, unlike the word if or the word when, which suggests it's that moment in time. That's when the property, the money is paid. But as all the property is sold has a different connotation to me.
Well, if you take that connotation, you're ignoring if, and you're ignoring when, and you're ignoring all.
No,
I think so.
It just suggests the contract is somewhat ambiguous to me. I can't tell you what it means because of the words if and when. You're absolutely right. Can't ignore them. But I'm not sure that it's absolutely clear to me how you interpret all of those words, the three words, when they seem, in my view, have some different sense to them.
Well, the confusion, I think, comes from that term is used sometimes in different contexts, if, as, and when.
Imports, I think, if you look at it in the dictionary, has more of a connotation of a continuum of time. But anyway, I've said enough there.
But when you interpret this, you use all the words that are used.
You do.
And you don't just isolate down on one.
Absolutely.
And when you take if, when, all, if you're going to come down on just using as, you almost have to ignore those three words.
I'm not saying that.
I understand.
I'm just saying that with that insertion in the provision, it's maybe not as clear as the attorneys may have thought. But I do have another question, if I can just proceed really quickly.
Yes.
This is the only other one, I think. The interpretation, what is wrong with this interpretation of the term? The monies of $1.4 million are to be paid to the husband. And that constitutes a clear obligation of debt, right? Wife owes husband $1,400 million, right?
Okay.
And that is to be held, it's not to be paid, over. That the paying over or the distribution of the amounts to be owed, say such as alimony that's to be paid in lump sum over 10 months or something, the payment schedule is governed by if, as, and when. Does anybody interpret it that way?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I really think that...
If it were to be interpreted that way, what's the implication on this contract in terms of the particular claimed error that the court could not hold the money already acquired by the sale in escrow?
Well, the implication of that is we're adding a term and condition to the agreement that was reached in 2006, 8 years later.
Which term? Escrow?
No, there was no escrow in that document.
Yeah, we're adding that term.
We're adding a different security contingency that wasn't in the agreement and it wasn't in the order. And we're doing it 8 years later.
I do have one more question, then I'm going to be quiet. Does the court have the power to enforce a contract? For example, could the court order that the monies be held in escrow? Because
no.
It, as an enforcement of the contract, not changing any?
I don't think so. This contract can be, well, the court dismissed the contempt proceeding because she was in compliance. And then it went on to rule, which was an addition to their agreement. Now, in their agreement, they distributed this property to him, this property to her.
Let me change it. Let's suppose all the property's been sold. This is a hypothetical, okay? So I'm not going to hold you anything.
Okay.
All the property's been sold, and the wife hasn't paid it over, right? And the court is asked to make sure, while a dispute is being resolved, that the money is not spent. There's nothing in the contract that says the court can order it to be held somewhere, say in escrow. Isn't that an inherent power of the divorce court to protect monies owed in a divorce situation?
Not until all the property is sold.
Property's all sold.
And I made this example to the court. I try a jury trial in Nelson County. I get a judgment. Mm-hmm. At that point, that's all I've got.
Yes.
I don't have a collection mechanism yet. And that's all they had here was an obligation. There was no collection mechanism in their agreement or the order that ratified the agreement. The collection mechanism was made up 8 years after the order was entered.
Well, and there's no collection vehicle. The obligation, the debt, was an inchoate sort of thing, if I follow correctly, in order to collect all the property needed to be sold, and husband needed to survive. I mean, needed to be alive at the time of the last sale.
Right.
Otherwise, it doesn't even go to him. It goes
correct.
On to the children.
I mean, it may never be owed to him. I mean, he may die, she may die, the estate may owe it. She may never owe him the money. And during all this time, she's paying the carrying costs on the property she has not sold.
Let me shift gears, because we're getting close to the end of your, we're almost into your rebuttal time. We're within a minute or so
okay.
of it. The fees, if I understand correctly, there's not a separate written property settlement agreement. Agreement was reached. The agreement was dictated into the court record, and that was incorporated into the
pursuant to statute.
And so there's not a separate fee term in the property settlement
that is correct.
Agreement.
That,
all right.
That is correct.
So what were these bases for awarding fees?
Well, I think he filed a motion for contempt under oath. Made a claim that was not viable. He knew that all the property had not been sold. In fact, 324 acres were still left to be sold, and that's in the record. And the Jensen case posed the identical problem, and I pointed out in the brief, it's not published. However, it is very illustrative of this situation. And in that case, the court said, you made your deal, you can't go back on your deal. It is a condition precedent to receiving any money. All must sell first. And that was the case there. And I found no published case that says otherwise.
You had raised a jurisdiction. I mean, do you agree that under Code Section 20-107.3 that the court has the power, the jurisdiction to enforce the terms of the divorce decree, even after 21 days?
No. It can enforce the terms, but it can't change them.
Oh,
here they added a mechanism to enforce it.
Right.
And that's a different story.
Right. I follow what you're saying.
2103K talks about pensions. And what I said to the lower court was, if the quadro said, if, as, and when all the retirement pension is paid, nobody would take that quadro.
Okay. You're at your 5 minute mark.
Thank you, sir.
Don't see the Jensen case when you get up, maybe it's in here. You mentioned Jensen. When you come back to
the
rebuttal, you can tell me where it is. Okay?
Page 203. Appendix.
Appendix 203, but it's not in your brief.
Mr. Moore?
We quoted our brief, and we cited the appendix.
Got it. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Moore. I'm with the firm of Phillips, Morrison, Johnson & Farrell, and I represent today Mr. John Hutchinson, the appellee, and he's also assigned a crosshair. Your Honors, to us this case is about finding a way to construe this agreement, in a way that harmonizes everything that's there, to find that the parties have a complete agreement, and to look at this language in a way that considers the context in which it was created. And what happened, and I'll go through just the important facts, I think, here, is the parties were before the court with their counsel, and they entered this agreement orally on the record. And they said that this was their complete agreement, that they expected it to have the same force and effect as a written property settlement agreement, and they're bound today by it. And so saying that, they went on to express the terms of the agreement. And the first thing that's important is that the counsel for Mrs. Hutchinson got up to define what the Merritt Hutchinson property was, and said that all the property referenced and referred to as Merritt Hutchinson Resort in Lynch Station, Virginia, and essentially it is all the property that is referenced and referred to as Merritt Hutchinson Resort. It is really all the real estate the parties own in Virginia. So they're defining the subject of the agreement. And this goes to our interpretation here. All doesn't have to create a condition precedent. It's used elsewhere in the agreement, and it doesn't create a condition precedent. All is a part of the subject term of the agreement. So when they go on next to say, if, as, and when all the properties sell, saying, as the you could say the properties is synonymous with all the Merritt Hutchinson properties. They're synonymous with one another. It's consistent with the way the terms are used in the agreement. But more importantly, Shortly after this is stated, the council put a couple other things on the record, but Mr. Deal, let me find this, it stood up. Sorry, my pages are stuck. And said to the court, and this is actually Mrs. Hutchinson's attorney first, we just want to clarify one point and restate it. And this is Mr. Deal, who was Dr. Hutchinson's attorney at the time, said, let me maybe state it for Mr. Hutchinson if I could read it. What basically we did was come up with what we thought was a fair settlement figure. This is a settlement figure. They're settling equitable distribution. The $1.4 million obligation of Mrs. Hutchinson is going to be paid solely from the resort net sales proceeds. So the money can only come from the net sales proceeds off the top. Off the top, and it's common sense, is going to mean the first net sales proceeds that come in.
What's the page reference on the joint?
Your Honor, this is page 24,
thank you.
Lines 2 through 9. He goes on to say, in other words, it would be if, as, and when the closing occurs at closing. And I would agree with the court that there's some indication that they expected one sale to occur at this time. It says, then any balance, we want to clarify for the record, then any balance would go to Mrs. Hutchinson, whatever that is. If it sells for any amount over that, she would be responsible. So this is
it just be one sale?
Well, Your Honor, I'm saying it could be implied from the terms of what they're saying, because he says, if, as, and when the closing occurs at closing. So it may have been expected by the parties at this time.
I'm a little puzzled about something I have to ask
sure.
about. It sounds like that there was some parole evidence offered in this case, even though you all stipulated it was not ambiguous.
Well, Your Honor, there was some...
Well, I'm talking about the proffers by counsel.
Mm-hmm.
The proffers by counsel are explaining the contract. They're outside the four corners of the contract.
Your Honor,
was it relied on by the court?
Your Honor, I would start by taking a little bit of issue about characterizing the stipulation.
Well,
and
I think you have to do that, but
yes.
if it is stipulated as not ambiguous, how can the court have taken clarification by the agent, if you will, of the parties as to what the terms meant? That's parole evidence.
I understand that, Your Honor, and if we go back and read, and I could find the citation in the record for you, and I believe I'd refer to that in a footnote in my brief, but what was stipulated to is that the attorneys weren't going to call each other to testify. And what Dr. Hutchinson's counsel said at trial, that was Mr. Morrison, said, whether it's ambiguous is up to the court. That's a direct quote from the record. What we stipulate to is we're not going to call Mr. Barnes or Mr. Deal and put them on to say what they thought it meant. And so I think there's some disagreement as to what was stipulated to. And to respond to your earlier question, it is a question of law whether it's ambiguous or not. And parties can stipulate the law all they want to. It's not binding on any court anywhere. So I would just offer that to the court that I think that has no effect whatsoever.
So was parole evidence taken in this case?
Your Honor, parole evidence was taken to a certain degree. I don't know that any, I mean, it depends on how you want to interpret some of it. I think it was parole evidence, but it was important to note, and this was stated to the court, that she sold some but not all the property for $1.9 million. The property that's left is worth less than $1.4 million. So it's impossible, factually impossible, for him to be paid $1.4 million off the top at closing when closing occurs, when all the property's been sold. So if we want to take the construction that they're offering to the court, that all the property has to be sold, that's an impossibility now. But there is a way to interpret this agreement so that problem doesn't arise. So it is a complete agreement. And that, again, is understanding all the property is synonymous with the properties, or it's referring to the subject term of the agreement, not creating a condition precedent. And that's the interpretation we offer to the court. And the trial court struggled with this some. Ultimately, dealing with this language of off the top and she only gets the proceeds after the sale occurs, and created the order that led to the escrow of the money. But we urge then and we urge now that there's a way to unify all of this so it makes sense, and that's just to simply read this term as a subject term, not a condition precedent. And again, all in these, it's referred to in the singular, the plural, without all. There's multiple references throughout this agreement and transcript to the property in different ways. So saying all doesn't create a condition precedent is consistent with the language in the agreement that you read in the transcript.
Counsel,
yes.
Under basic contract law, if we determine there's ambiguity, it's to be construed against the drafter, correct?
Your Honor, strictly, yes, normally agreement is to be strictly construed against the drafter. In this case, I would argue that would be Mrs. Hutchinson, but I don't know that.
How would you argue that?
Well, I guess if we were to take the balance of who was speaking at trial, Judge, I don't know how we would say who the drafter was.
I mean, honestly,
I haven't thought of that. That's a good question.
That's part of the concern, right?
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
Well, in fairness, this was negotiated by counsel represented parties on each side, and there was no writing per se. It was a matter of both of you dictating into the record what the deal was.
That's true, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I think there is agreement, and again, going back to this language where they clarified what if, as, and when meant, both agreed that the money was to be paid off the top at closing when closing occurs. And
if we find that this is ambiguous, the only thing we can do is remand for parole evidence in the court below, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they can apply whatever principles one applies to contract interpretation, including against whom any ambiguities or any terms are held against. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I did request our relief if the court found it ambiguous, which it's free to do. It could be remanded for additional evidence.
I'm wondering if there was any evidence. Except what counsel clarified.
Sure, what counsel stipulated. I would say there's really not a whole lot of evidence on the intent of the parties.
Well, would there be anything else
no,
for any?
No.
Judge, I guess the parties could testify as to what they intended. And that might probably be very.
If the court, of course, and this is what happened. The court accepted the stipulation that it was not ambiguous, so there was no reason to hear from anybody.
And although we disagree with the conclusion the court reached because of how it interpreted the condition precedent into the agreement, we felt strongly and still do that there's a way to construct this so it's not ambiguous.
Yes, but you don't challenge the finding of non-ambiguity on appeal, do you?
We haven't, Judge, because of our interpretation, which treats all as part of the subject term, makes it non-ambiguous. In fact, our interpretation is the only one I think that's available that doesn't create all sorts of havoc with the agreement, because you have this language that says only the net proceeds above what he's paid are her sole and separate property. He gets paid off the top at closing. She gets whatever remains after he's paid. And if you create a condition precedent, it becomes a chaotic agreement, an incomplete agreement. When you just simply say all was just an expression of what they're referring to, what the subject of the agreement of. When
so tell me what happens, if we take your interpretation, mm-hmm. what is supposed to happen if under that interpretation in the trial court?
Your Honor,
he gets to be paid something or not?
With our interpretation, he would be paid the $1.4 million, which is currently in escrow on pending appeal. The money's being held now on the appeal bond. We were asking the court to award him interest on that $1.4 million from the date of the closing to present. So we would ask the trial court to determine that amount and increase the award by that much. But
so all the property is worth more than $1.4, but there is that amount in escrow. That's what you're saying.
Correct. The $1.4 million has been ordered into escrow by the trial judge for this appeal. But the property that remains to be sold is worth less than $1.4 million. And the position they're taking is that $1.4 million is hers. She can do whatever she wants with it. And then when she decides to sell the last postage stamp piece, as I think I said in my brief, of property, then she has to pay him the $1.4 million. Well, she could never do that.
But your position is that the term all in the clause that's before us refers to all of the property, not just the property of the Merritt Hutchinson Resort.
Well, Your Honor, and going back to how counsel had tried to clarify this in the transcript, all the property in this context refers to the property subject to the $1.4 million, you know, being paid when it's sold.
Is the Merritt Hutchinson report.
Correct.
Resort, isn't it?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so when the statement was made, when all the real estate that makes up the aforementioned properties is sold, the aforementioned is the resort.
Your Honor, I believe you're referring to the final decree.
Yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure I was in the right place.
Joint Appendix 462.
And Your Honor, I think the same interpretation could apply there, even though I would argue that the final decree, if it conflicts at all with what's in the transcript, it doesn't apply. 2155 says that the premarital act, although the sections of that statute apply to marital agreements just as well, and 2153 says once you have an executed agreement, which the parties say there was an executed agreement, and the law says there was an executed agreement that day in court, the only way you can modify or amend it is by a written agreement signed by the parties, and that never occurred. So if there is a conflict, and of course 2109.1 also says no order shall be entered It's contrary.
Are you suggesting that there is a conflict between what was agreed to on the record and that term of the divorce decree?
I think it could be read the same way to also be part of the subject term, and that's reasonable and it's consistent with all of the other terms of the agreement that was set forth in the transcript and with the final decree. I don't think it's as strong an argument. I think that if you can interpret a conflict, it needs to be disregarded because what controls is the transcript.
Well, if we were to be governed at all by the terms of the divorce decree, then all would refer to all of the Merritt Hutchinson Resort property, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But that could be all of the Merritt Hutchinson Resort property. It could be the properties. They're, again, just that's synonymous with the properties going back again to, it was defined four or five different ways throughout this agreement. There was never, and all was used as a part of the definition of the subject term throughout the agreement. So I still think you could read it that way and it's consistent with everything else. And more importantly, everything makes sense when it's read that way. It all fits, it all works. We don't have the need for escrow. We don't have questions about there being an incomplete agreement. It all fits together. And that certainly, I think it's reasonable for the court to find that their intent, just based on reading this and what they said on the record, was to settle equitable distribution, to come to a fair settlement.
You do agree that an escrow is not provided for in any of the agreement?
Judge, I agree. I mean, you read the agreement, the word escrow doesn't appear anywhere in it. But as for the court's authority to enforce its orders, I think it has the authority to do that. And I think here it has it's fashioning an order to carry out the intent of the parties as expressed in their agreement. And I don't think it's outside the authority of the court to do that. In fact, I think it would be a terrible mess if the courts couldn't do those sorts of things. So I don't know of any authority that said the court cannot do this.
You're very close to the end of your time, so if you can wrap her up.
Sure.
Please, thank you.
Judge, I don't know if there's much more to add except for the fact that, again, I would repeat, and I know I don't need to with this court, but our interpretation harmonizes all of the terms. In the context of the agreement, the way that we're asking the court to construe all of the properties or all the Merritt Hutchinson properties or all the different phrases that are used, when the court construes that as a subject term, this all pulls together and it's a complete whole. And in fact, this entire case would be over because that money would have been paid already, as it should have been, and we wouldn't be here today. It's fairly straightforward, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Burns, your remaining 5 minutes.
Just to clarify, but not change, there's no escrow in the lower court. There was a bond posted for the $1.4 million, but there's no escrow. Now, there was no parole evidence relied on by the judge. He accepted the stipulation of the two lawyers, and that's in his opinion.
The stipulation regarding clarifying the language of
No, stipulation that there was no ambiguity.
Okay.
And
can you make that kind of a stipulation?
Pardon me?
Can a judge accept that kind of stipulation?
As the law
if it's
in
a
this case,
law?
Yes. As the law in this case, yes. I think he can.
Okay.
Now, you ask about the word as. Look at page 7 of our reply brief. The words all and as have been used together without conflict in a number of ways. HGCA Retail Services against Broadway Realty. A brokerage agreement stated the commission was earned only if, as, and when all the commission payment conditions were satisfied. So it didn't get a little bit of the money as it was going along. That term was interpreted to mean until all of it's done. Same in the rest of the cases I cite there. Jensen, which is on page, the finding and conclusion in Jensen is on page 203 of the appendix. In light of these findings and facts and conclusions of law, the court issued a declaratory judgment as follows. The if, as, and when language in paragraph 21 of the June 22, 1990 agreement creates a condition precedent that will not occur until Reb and Bonnie should come to sell all rights to all the Pulpus property. Now, I can see this is not a published opinion, but this is dead on the facts. They had the dead on the facts agreement. They had the dead on the facts conclusion that we think you should reach. Regardless of the occurrence of non-occurrence of condition precedent, regardless of the occurrence or non-occurrence of the condition precedent, Reb's moral obligation related to the compensating Arn for any windfall resulting from the sale of pulpits is committed to REB's discretion and not judicial determination. The June agreement does not impose on REB any obligation to sell pulpits, which was agreed to here, and there's no obligation to escrow money, as the court noted, in the agreement or in the final decree. They're calling this enforcement. I'm calling it a change.
Let me back up to the bond. The court could impose a bond until that money is paid, couldn't it? Or is it only with respect to the appeal?
It's the appeal. It's the appeal.
It's only the appeal.
It's only the appeal. It's an appeal bond. And that's in the record, too.
Yes, yes, it is.
And I point to the fact that there was no parole evidence relied on by the judge. In fact, he says that in his opinion. We did stipulate that all the property was not sold, so the condition preceding has not been met. 324 acres are still unsold, for which he still has an obligation to pay taxes, upkeep, and all that sort of thing. That's really not in the record either. But this is not a one-way street, but it is an agreement they reached. And to allow there to be a different mechanism of enforcement now, or security now, than they originally agreed to, changes the deal. And it changes the deal that they made pursuant to 20-109, and it changes the court's order pursuant to Rule 1:1. And it changes the court's order 8 years later. I mean, 21 days, we're not even counting. And I rely on the rest of my brief.
Yes, sir. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. We'll come down and